You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Castor. Good afternoon, Yosef.
Yeah, lots of science today. Lots of interesting stuff. Giving me a bit of a chuckle as I was reading the mobile phones, particularly. But we start off with genetic fingerprinting.
Indeed.
Right. Yeah. What's going on with what even is genetic fingerprinting?
Well, that's a good question. So it's basically looking at your DNA. Let's say that's it in simple terms.
Hmm.
Now, the reason that we're going to talk about this today is that it's very, very unusual that you can actually pin a great scientific discovery down to one day.
Yeah.
And this is one that you can, because on this day 40 years ago, so the 10th of September 1984, a guy by the name of Dr. Alec Jeffries, who's now Sir Alec, for reasons that will become pretty obvious, he was playing around in his lab at the University of Leicester. And he was basically a researcher in DNA.
Yeah. Okay?
And probably, as many listening will know, the structure of DNA was figured out in about 1953, I think, by Watson and Crick and Co. and Franklin and et cetera, et cetera. And basically, DNA consists of, it's essentially a four-letter alphabet.
Yeah.
Let's say, okay, so we've got A, we've got A's, C, yeah, we've C's, got G, G's, and we've got T's.
Yeah,
okay.
Classic stuff.
And that's basically it. So these things are called bases, and each of them is labelled whatever, you know. So we've got an A base and a C base and a G and a T. And to make up sort of the human genome, we've got about 3.5, I think, about billion of these guys, sort of. And what they do is, you know, it's a big long strand of DNA, and they repeat in different orders along that strand of DNA, okay? So we've got these four letters, and they're busy in different orders or the same orders or whatever. And what we find is that for humans, around about 99.9% of every human's DNA is basically identical. And so it's the 0.1% bits that we're interested in, because those are the bits that differ and make us different as to, you know, as to how we are, I guess. So,
right.
So everybody on the planet, except with the exception of identical twins, and even with identical twins, sometimes you get differences in DNA. Everyone's got their own unique DNA. And so he was doing an experiment. And again, this is in the early days of this technique, obviously, because he's the guy that invented it. And he was looking at the DNA of his lab technician and their parents. And on the 10th of September 1984, he was looking at the results of this. So sort of an X-ray picture of these individuals' DNA. And basically he came to the realization that, hey, we've got differences between the DNA of these three people. And these differences are going to be enough to allow us to basically distinguish between them.
Right.
And that, as I'm sure you can all understand, was a massive, massive advance.
Yeah.
Okay? And this is the first time that this had been basically proposed, that, yes, you can potentially use DNA to distinguish people.
And massive ramifications there, right?
Huge ramifications, okay? And so the first of those ramifications came with the Immigration Department, of all things, in the UK. And they wanted to check on the identity of a British boy who had family from Ghana.
Right.
Okay. And so basically what they did, they took the DNA from the boy, they took the DNA from some family members, and they basically showed that, yep, that boy's provenance, shall we say, for want of a better word, was indeed from his family. So, you know,
he was obviously related. Connected them there.
To them. Yeah. And so not only does it tell you the individuality of people, but it also tells you, you know, basically connections.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what we all do nowadays. We, you know, swab our mouth, send it off to ancestry.com, and, you know, you find out basically where you came from. Now, we're probably most used to sort of DNA fingerprinting with respect to crime.
Yes, right. Okay. That was my first thought as well.
Absolutely. And so this was first used in this format in terms of crime to solve a double murder. So two young girls had been murdered, I think around about 3 years apart in the early 80s in the UK. And so the police came to Jeffreys and said, okay, can we possibly use this? Because we've got a suspect in custody.
Right.
And he's confessed to the crimes, and so, or he's confessed to one of the crimes, sorry.
Right.
And we just want to, you know, make sure, can we use this to confirm that he was the perpetrator?
Yeah.
And so they took swabs from, they had DNA swabs from the body, et cetera, from bodies, and they actually showed that it wasn't him.
Wow. That's very interesting.
And so this was, you know, this is one of these false confessions.
Yeah.
And what they then did, having shown that that wasn't the case, they then basically got about 5,000 men from the area,
yep,
and they asked them to give samples. Okay. And long story short, from one of those people, they found a match.
Identified the killer. Wow.
Basically, they identified the killer, and the killer of two of these girls, and so he's still in jail today. The next thing that they managed to do was to actually identify Joseph Mengele. So the nasty, evil person from Auschwitz. And so they had some remains of his, and they basically found out that, yes, you know, they could identify him from his relationship to living relatives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And
right.
So they showed, you know, basically, incontrovertibly, that those remains were his. And now, when they did this, so in 1984, they needed a lot of sample. Okay, they need massive amounts of sample. So really, it was going to be pretty impractical.
Yeah.
However, there was a discovery made in 1983, just sort of the year before, that basically allowed DNA amplification. That if you got a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of DNA, that you could then make copies of that,
and
make copies of the copies and copies of the copies of the copies, etc. And basically, you could amplify a tiny, tiny amount of DNA, which you could really do very, very little with, to a massive amount, which you could then quite happily use. And that discovery got a guy by the name of Kerry Mullis a Nobel Prize in chemistry for that. And really, really interesting. So, you know, now I'm sure if you've watched any true crime documentary or anything like that, you will see that, DNA has identified the killer. But very, very interestingly, 375 DNA exonerations in the States between 1989 and 2020. So that's 375 innocent people.
Yeah.
Some of whom, 21 in fact, were on death row.
Wow.
And 44 of whom had actually pled guilty to crimes that they didn't commit. And
so,
why people do that, I just cannot understand. But, you know, this discovery that was made 40 years ago today has saved
370 huge implications
lives.
Then,
And of those 375, I think they managed to get about 160 of the actual perpetrators in 160
That's
cases.
Incredible.
So all through just looking at DNA.
Yeah.
And so that... You know, that happened 40 years ago today, and I think that that's something that should
amazing,
be
amazing. Yeah, amazing.
Absolutely,
by Alec Jeffreys. Yeah,
yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and then next we've got this gave me, as mentioned, a chuckle. Mobile phones, brain cancer. There's, I mean, what's the relationship there, right?
Well, zero.
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 Yeah.
Okay, so we shouldn't really have to even say this, but the reason that we do have to say this, and okay, so a little bit of background. So there's a study just come out.
Yep.
Which it's it's basically a review article of a bunch of studies. So 63 studies made between 1994 and 2022, which have found no association between brain cancer, head cancer, neck cancer, and the use of mobile phones. Now, the reason why we have to say this was in 2011. So a bunch of folk called the International Agency for Research on Cancer, who were related to the World Health Organization, they classified exposure to radio waves as a possible carcinogen in humans. Now, the reason that they said this was, again, they had looked at a limited amount of studies where, you know, they're looking at some sort of connection, or any possible connection between mobile phones and brain cancer. And the problems with these studies were that in pretty much all cases, the people involved had over-reported their use of mobile phones.
Right.
And that skewed the results very, very much to one side. Yep. Okay. So what this latest study has done is basically use, not surprisingly, a much, much larger data set, because now we're sort of, you know, 13 or 14 years down the track from then. They've gone through each of the studies in detail and basically thrown out the rubbish ones. Okay, so there are around about, believe it or not, about 500 or so studies looking at the possibility of the connection between...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it makes sense, right? You'd want to investigate that for sure.
Yeah. And so they've gone through and, you know, basically, yeah, as I say, got rid of the rubbish ones.
Yep.
And they ended up with, of those 500 odd, they've ended up with 63 that are genuine, possible, you know, sensible scientific studies.
That's quite a big culling there.
And then, you know, as I say, what they found is there's no association between brain cancer, head cancer, neck cancer, and use of mobile phones. And again, this is pretty blindingly obvious, should I say, because over that period of time, the use of mobile phones has increased massively.
Yeah, okay? Right.
Massively. You know, consider the early 2000s, something like that.
Not at all.
To now,
yeah.
You know, nobody was using them then. And now, you know,
almost everyone.
Everybody's got a phone.
And I'm sure, if I'm going to guess what you're about to say, I'm sure there's not been a similar increase in brain cancer.
There we go.
Right.
There we go. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, this one should be done and dusted and put to bed.
It seems illogical.
Sadly.
Just look at those two statistics side by side.
Yeah, yeah.
Makes total sense.
Now, sadly, it probably won't be.
Mm.
And I think there'll still be believers out there. And I'm not quite sure what can be done about that.
Yeah, I imagine if you've been presented with evidence and you're still believing to the contrary, I'm not sure.
Yep, yep.
There's not much more that can be done there. But
interestingly, they were talking about, we're still going to do this. You know, we're going to do this in the future. We're going to keep up some of these studies and everything and just, you know, just make sure.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a sensible and rational thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you can all breathe a little bit easier out there, I think.
Yeah, if you're a mobile phone
user.
Or a fence sitter there, maybe you weren't sure whether it would give you brain cancer or not. Now we're confirming.
There we go. Yes.
No risk there.
But I suppose the technology's like so commonplace that everyone's using it, it's probably good to be somewhat cautious about it
and be conducting
these studies because you want to make sure that the things that everyone's using healthy and not harmful in any way.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. But, you know, when you've found the answer, then, you know, then what more can you do?
Yeah. And speaking about being healthy, we've got eating well here. What's with...
Yeah, there's a bit of a puff piece, I think, just sort of throw this one in. There was a recent article in the New York Times basically talking about healthy eating, and it probably, you know, it's always good just to sort of revisit these things and, you know... And again, probably what I'm going to say is probably pretty common knowledge out there.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It does. And, you know, really it's probably a matter of probably self-control. That, you know, these are the things that we should be eating, but probably aren't. You know how it is. So do you want to live longer? That's the big question. Probably. Who doesn't?
Yeah, no? Good amount of people do.
I think so, yep. And so there was this article in the New York Times. So they're interviewing doctors and nutritionists and all of these folk, you know. And as I say, these results aren't going to surprise you. So what sort of things do we need? What sort of things should we be eating? Well, we should be eating protein.
Yep.
Absolutely. And that protein should come from plants.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Should be plant protein.
So flipping the script there.
If you want strong muscles, you want strong bones, then that's what you need. So... we're going to be eating legumes, we're going to be eating nuts, whole grains, and we're not going to get our protein from red meat.
Interesting.
Okay? Or,
interesting.
You know, if you do...
flipping the narrative.
Obviously minimise that.
Wow.
So, if you like your steaks... bugger. So, okay, we need protein, we need calcium, we need vitamin D. Okay? And both of those we need for strong bones.
Yep, that makes sense.
Absolutely. So... no surprises here. Milk
yep.
is a biggie. OJ, Cereals.
Yeah.
Okay, those sorts of things. Sunlight, your vitamin D, okay?
That one, I mean, that's obvious, right? Yeah. I feel.
It is. And again, I mean, there's an old story from around about sort of the 1950s, 1960s, where a lot of Asian immigrants ended up in Scotland.
Right.
And started getting rickets.
Yes, right.
And rickets is a vitamin D deficiency. Good old Scotland's not particularly sunny.
Yeah.
You know? And so this manifested itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, getting out in the sun, obviously not too much, is good for you.
And I mean, it's no coincidence that you feel better on a sunny day, right?
True. Yeah. And so other sources, fish, mushrooms, eggs. They're good. We need polyphenols, okay, or otherwise known as antioxidants. And this one, I've got to say, I was really surprised. Coffee.
Wow.
Ooh, coffee.
That's a big part of your diet.
They're talking 3 to 5 cups a day.
Jeez. Oh, wow.
Let's go.
Yusuf already well on his way to
I'm
a long life.
So that certainly surprised
that's
me.
That's so surprising.
I know. Berries, leafy green veggies, avocados, extra virgin olive oil, they're all good stuff.
Mm.
We need healthy fats, so again, we need the olive oil and we need the avocado and we need sort of the fatty fish, so we need things like your salmons and your tuna, anchovies, anybody?
Yeah.
And sardines, those sorts of things. They're all full of good old omega-3 fatty acids and stuff. They're good for you. What don't we eat? You don't eat processed foods. Processed meat. Oh, Yosef's making a face right now. So we keep away from the processed foods. We keep away from our fizzy drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend towards things like your good old Mediterranean diet. You
right.
know, that's an oft-stated fact that, you know.
Classic stuff.
Get into that. Get into your plant-based stuff. All of that stuff is good for you. So, you know, if you're on a health kick today, those are the things that you should be consuming.
And coffee.
Coffee.
That's incredible.
I know. I'll have to start drinking.
Maybe I'll go back to drinking coffee. I've been off it for a while, but
I've never been on it.
The health benefits seem to be abundantly clear.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for coming in today, Alan, and for sharing this science news with us. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.